Welcome to the Memory Distillery, everyone. I'm Anthony Veneri.
And I'm John Deck, and each week we will malt, mash, ferment, and distill our way through the spirits of our past in the form of long-loved movies.
And this week, it's all right, Captain. We always knew you were a whoopsie. That's right, we're watching Stardust from the year 2007, directed by Matthew Vaughn. And we're doing it a little different this time around, aren't we, John?
That's correct. We've actually just already watched this, and we're just going to dive right into it. But I do want to ask, you know, as far as going into watching Stardust, you've brought it up once or twice before in our conversations about, you know, being a movie you enjoyed. And I'm just wondering, were there any particular memories tied to that from when you, you know, first saw it? Because it's been, what, about 14 or so years now?
Yeah, I mean, and it's been close to that since I watched it prior to this viewing. Like I watched it, I want to say I watched it in like 2009 for the first time, and I liked it. I liked it a lot, and I just, for some reason, I never got back around to watching it again. So when you would mention let's watch Stardust, I was like, oh yeah, like totally. Probably my favorite, and I think a lot of the Stardust fans out there will agree, is the Captain Shakespeare sequence. I think that the entire thing, and not just like the cross-dressing dancing bit, but like his entire persona where he's, you know, living this duality, I think is just it's a fantastic sequence, and Robert De Niro plays it so well. And he's so fun to watch in this, and I have such a great time. What about you?
You know, it's strange because I'd say by and large, I mean, I know we're both big fans of Neil.
Your good friend, Neil.
My good friend, Neil. Yeah, we're constantly comparing notes, and he's begging me for my help in editing his work and all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. And when this movie had first come out, I remember just being very unattached to it. And I think that could just be because the tone and feel of it compared to the novel was just a different experience for me.
And that's very true.
And so, like, I won't say I disliked it, but I just kind of dismissed it. I just blocked it out of my head and as, like, okay, it's its own thing, and there it goes. And I just hadn't really thought about it again. So coming into this was extremely fresh. I did recall Claire Danes was in it, and I recalled Robert De Niro was in it. And that's like about the extent of, in terms of the movie and the performances and everything that happened, that I remembered. So I didn't have like a very strong, wistful, nostalgic look. It was almost like reverse, where what do you call the reverse of nostalgia? I don't know, but whatever it was, whatever it is, it was kind of like that, you know, mild blocking of memory, and it all came back. Like I even forgot, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer was in and stuff until I started watching. And so, yeah, it all kind of came back to me as I was watching, and it was a perfectly pleasant experience.
And I wonder if maybe that's why we have that departure. So admittedly, I was late to the Neil Gaiman game. Like I hadn't read any of his books prior to seeing this for the first time. So I didn't get the opportunity to read Stardust and then find out, you know, oh, they made a movie of it. It was the reverse. Like I watched Stardust and found out, oh, this was adapted from a book. And so I think I appreciated it all the more because I didn't have, like, you know how you could say it with any book that gets adapted into a movie, like you have that expectation of this is how I envisioned this particular scene in the book playing out. And then, you know, so-and-so gets their hands on it and we end up with the Dark Tower. So,
this wasn't a Dark Tower departure.
No,
from...
no, not at all. That's the extreme for sure. But like you have this expectation and reality sets in, you know, 20 minutes into the movie, that, oh, this isn't going to really be like the book.
I mean, well, first of all, I do want to address the elephant in the room, or perhaps the elephant in the room, depending upon if you pronounce Neil's last name Gaiman or Gaiman, which I know we could probably do an internet search and find out what he prefers or something, because I've just heard both so many times.
I have too. I just almost go like Gaiman because I'm pretty, I Googled it and Google told me it was Gaiman. And so enough. I was like, oh, all right. Well, you know, Google knows.
And
Google knows
everything. Considering he's one of my best friends, you'd think he would just have corrected me by now if he didn't like it. I think right. he's fine with whatever, as long as it comes from a place of, you know, love and respect. So
of course. Yeah.
John I only bring that up because I definitely, you know, maybe not the second, but I do want to get a bit more into some of his other works and, you know, and talk about that, and to just keep calling him Neil familiarly without including a surname just feels a little bit weird. So at any rate, the experience overall was interesting. And you bring up, you know, Captain Shakespeare's performance in Robert De Niro. Or I should say Robert De Niro's performance as Captain Shakespeare. And
no, I think you had it right the first time.
Sure, I usually do. and it's interesting because it was like, on the one hand, I kind of enjoyed it. It was fun. There were elements to it that were kind of good. And then I almost felt like, am I supposed to be mildly offended? Like I know the world at large is so sensitive now that we can get offended if, you know, a sheet of notebook paper is mostly white. And we're just like, what? But right, like, yeah. There's a million things that can trigger people. But it's just like, it was, and maybe because it's been a little while, and this was, what, 2007, was it? Or around that time?
Yeah, 2007.
Yeah, like, so perhaps language and how, you know, these tropes weren't communicating the same ways. Like, certainly this was a departure from typical De Niro characters, and so to have him start off as this rough and gruff captain was pretty expected, and to have the twist be that he was an oopsie or a whoopsie, I should say.
A whoopsie.
But like, it was almost like do you know what I'm saying? I kind of towed that line between being like making fun of, like, how ridiculous would it be if someone was like this for real? And then, like, the fact that you could be someone who is a bit more flamboyant and someone who is enjoys wearing, you know, women's clothing and makeup and dancing, and still be more than a two-dimensional character. So, like, it had pros and cons to it, but overall, yeah, I mean, he definitely played it for exactly what, you know, they would want, and so I wasn't unpleased by that.
No, and I think that towing the line or walking the line is a good way to put that, because there's definitely a very, very wrong way of doing that. And I don't feel like they ventured into that. I think that they were respectful of the character and the situation and definitely had fun with it, but we're also like not insensitive, I think. So
I like the little like twist within a twist of the fact that like he's not this ruthless, you know, air pirate, and he's actually more sensitive, and he just fakes that because he doesn't want to be murdering and killing people. And then but he does that to demand the respect of his crew, and then to find out, well, the crew knew that it was an act, and like, so it just is a big cyclical thing. And maybe, you know, the crew understood what having the reputation means, that, you know, they get by with, you know, less, you know, conflict and more treasure and who knows what.
Yeah, but they still love him in the end anyway, so it's all good. Let's take a break here where we normally would, just so if anybody wants to go and watch it, they can. It's on Netflix right now, so head on over there and watch it, or get it from your personal library, blah, 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 blah. And when we come back,
and we're back. We took a very, very long rest and relaxation so that you guys would all have 2 hours and 5 minutes or so to watch the movie. I hope it was worth it. And now we can just get back into our conversation about Shakespeare in Love.
Yes, Shakespeare in Love. What a wonderful film.
It was a revelatory bit of something or other. Yep. And I really think that Queen Elizabeth's going to get an Oscar.
Yep. And the gunfighting wow, just beautifully choreographed. John Woo did a great job.
Yeah, did they? Was that Gun Kata? Gung Fu? You know,
Gun,
it's one of those.
Gun Fu, but with flintlocks, which to do that is just so artistically, I can't keep this up.
And the dragons. Oh, we're not keeping it up. Okay. so you know, it was a lot of fun watching it for a couple of different reasons. One was the cast, because there are so many people in this cast that I know that I just
forgot were in it.
Well, like, I didn't even know them for a lot of them for anything else back in the time, or I didn't pay attention or wasn't really caring. But it was great to just see these different characters who I'm like, it hits me, and it takes me like a solid like 30 seconds for I'm like, wait, I just saw this person. Who is this person? I had that happen at least like two or three different times. And so that was a lot of fun. Like, I have to say, I have one absolute favorite. I don't know what you call it, like a side character, a minor character in this.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any in particular? You brought up Robert De Niro, and that's like a fairly main side character, but do you have any others that stick out?
I mean, the guard is pretty great, especially when Tristan tries to go through the wall instead of Dunstan and just gets his ass handed to him by this 97-year-old man. Yeah, I think him and maybe the brothers as a whole were a favorite, dead and alive. Like, they just were fun to watch and see them kind of poke fun at each other and you know, take digs and things like that.
Tay Diggs,
what?
Yeah, he was my favorite.
Take Diggs.
All right. Well, I have to say that my favorite character in the movie, and this took me a moment to piece together who I was looking at, but was when, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer transformed the goat into a person.
Billy.
Like, I immediately was like, my first thought was, I know this actor, and I was like trying to remember who it was, and I was thinking, is this from, you know, Where Brother for, or Oh Brother We're Out? Now I'm like, kept going back and forth in my head. And then I realized it's Arthur Weasley from Harry Potter.
Yes.
And so he was a perfect goat or human, you know, who was a goat. And like, I love, you know, the funny, okay, well, you're just a random guy and I transformed you into a goat to pair up with this other goat. And then later turning both goats into humans and have him being Billy Goat.
Jumping up on the bar, not once, but twice.
Yes. Jumping up on the bar, the way he jutted his jaw out, and like the look in his eyes, he somehow captured that like scared, weird look goats get sometimes in their eyes. And so it was just, that was a lot of fun. And maybe out of the entire movie, presented the most joy for me in that, and that tiny little cameo.
It was pretty amazing. And I did enjoy that one a lot.
Of course, Ricky Gervais being there was also kind of funny, but that felt a little more like it was like hand built for him.
Oh yeah, I mean, come on, that particular delivery, and it was basically like watching a Ricky Gervais stand up, or you know, The Office, the UK Office.
Yeah,
but I mean, talking about like actors who I didn't even really truly recognize. Henry Cavill was in this, and yeah. I didn't even realize it until like we got to the end of the movie, and you had that whole like wink moment between Humphrey and Captain Shakespeare. Like,
oh, you didn't realize till the end?
No, not at all.
My first thought was, as I'm watching this develop, was like, I'm watching Superman fight Daredevil.
Well, that's another one though, is Charlie Cox being in there and have it be Daredevil, and I was like, wait a minute, he looks so familiar. And then I'm like, oh shit, that's Charlie Cox. You mentioned, what's her face before? Fuck.
Claire Danes?
Nope, the other one.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
and I had remembered her being in it, but I'd forgotten the transformation and how, because... Like, I've had this idea of Michelle Pfeiffer in my head for years, just from seeing her in Batman so many years ago, like of her being a late 20s, early 30s adult when I was a kid. So like for her in 2007 to still look so young and vibrant to me was like, wow, holy shit, that's a great, well done genes and or taking care of yourself. But
it's witchcraft.
And witchcraft, yes, of course, eating the heart of a star. But yeah, lots of names. Peter O'Toole, Sienna Miller, like,
yeah, I mean,
lots of people in this who I just did not realize were in it.
Well, and even Tristan's father in the flashback version, and I was just staring, I'm like, I'm like, oh, Punisher and Westworld, and like,
yeah,
yeah, like, and so it was just kind of even a small part, even the narrator, it was just, it struck me as
Surrey and McKellen, yeah.
Yeah, but like what was really funny is that when I'm listening to their voice, like it almost sounds like it's
Sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, definitely. I was not going to say Gandalf. Oh, okay. No, it sounded like Ian McKellen combined with Patrick Stewart. Because my first thought was, oh, Patrick Stewart narrated this. And then after another few sentences, I'm like, wait a second. I'm listening. I'm like, or is that Ian McKellen? And then I went back to think, I actually looked it up because I was distracted because I was like, it really, to me, and you should try this for fun, you at home listening, or Anthony, you should just listen to the intro again and imagine it being Patrick Stewart, because all of a sudden you'll be like, yeah, that sounds exactly like Patrick Stewart. And I love that, considering not only their, you know, Xavier Magneto dynamic and stuff, but just their friendship, which is one of my favorite things. And so
it's such a cool thing there.
And friendship. So it's just great to hear this narrator voice and to be able to like not be able to distinguish, because it just felt like it went back and forth between their voice.
No, I didn't get that same sense, but there's definitely that that moment where you can go, oh, is this, you can almost make a game out of it, like, is this Ian McKellen or Patrick Stewart? Maybe we'll turn that into a segment. Like, we'll just start playing clips of Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart on the show and go, okay, who is it?
I know what you want. Ian Patrick, who is it?
Oh, I'm going to get that drop.
I don't think the world at large enjoys that being every segment we do with that kind of intro, but you never know, maybe.
Maybe they do. Maybe you're the voice of a old generation.
I've always been that. I believe it's Pepsi.
So you wanted to talk some more Neil.
I did. My Let's good friend, do it. Neil Gaiman.
Neil Gaiman Gaiman.
So I believe this has been brought up once or twice, but you have not as of yet had a chance to watch any of American Gods, have you?
No, I haven't.
I'm not looking down on you for that necessarily.
No, but our audiences, and our audience is who I truly care about.
Yeah. I bring it up because as of this moment, I don't know, there's some decent adaptations. I feel like when you go back and look at some of the earlier stuff, it's like people didn't like know how to transform his vision, his creative vision, into like a tangible something to be seen. Mm-hmm. But do you have any favorites of movies or books or comics or anything that like you're into?
I mean, as far as Neil Gaiman goes, like there's plenty. There's Good Omens. There's American Gods. There's Norse Gods. His sort of retellings of those are probably one of my favorite books that he's written. Lucifer, come on, like Lucifer's an amazing show. There's a Coraline, like there's so much that he's done that's just brilliant. I think if I had to narrow it down to one, I'd probably say Good Omens, just because it's so much bang for your buck.
It's I can't argue, especially the David Tennant Michael Sheen adaptation cast of that, which is wonderful and hilarious and a great show. Like, I've had a bit of bewilderment and just a wonderful experience the first time I saw Coraline. It might be like the best movie I ever saw in 3D in the theater.
There's probably a short list of movies that I've seen in 3D that were worth it, but
yeah,
that's a pretty bold statement.
It was just the textures and that stop motion, and like when she's crawling through the tunnels between the parallel universes or whatever you want to call it, like it just felt so tangible and so being in the middle of it. Whereas I'd say at least a solid 85 to 90% of 3D just feels like add-on stuff where it's not more immersive. Sometimes you might have a cool shot or two, but it doesn't feel like it helps the story in any way. Like you have a movie like Avatar, whether you like that movie or not, I'm not talking about The Last Airbender. I'm talking about the James Cameron Avatar. Where
thank you for clarifying.
I may not necessarily have loved the movie, but the use of 3D and setting up the environment was just breathtaking. There's a reason why when they tried to make 3D TVs a thing, that was the only movie they ever demoed anywhere, because that was people, you know, wanting to recreate that experience. And so, like, I'm getting off track here. All that, you know, getting back to Coraline, that being great. But like right now, like, you know, American Gods, because I love the book so much, and the casting and the interpretation of what they're doing is so interesting. There might be some minor missteps here or there, but it's just so, so, so tasty. I'm not going to get into it until you get a chance to watch it, but
I'm like on the verge of putting The Expanse on hold so that I can go and watch American Gods and be caught up on it, so that we can have a proper conversation about it.
I mean, and if you, with The Expanse, like, are you in the first season still?
No, I just got into the second season.
Oh, I was going to say, just finish whatever season you're on if you just started.
Anyway. Yeah, I mean, I'm literally on the first episode of the second season, so, like.
Yeah, just put it on the back burner and go watch American Gods.
Yeah, all right.
You got stars.
I have all of it. Yeah, I can watch whatever I want. It's not a problem. It's just because a matter of finding time. I'm a grown up, but I'm also like a grown up who has a job and not time. Like, my time is split between work and my family and this.
Well, and you know, work, family, this, very important.
Very super important.
So getting back to the movie and Neil Gaiman, and the fact that, like, as we move forward, I think the formats that are occurring in media are going to make creators like Neil Gaiman to be more and more interpreted in a way that makes sense. And what I mean is just, like, with all the streaming services just dying for content and for, you know, premier high-level content for every Amazon and Netflix and Hulu, et cetera, Disney, that are all looking to like build universes. Like, he is just one of the best universe builders, bar none. And so, like, every intellectual property he has, I feel, has a shot or a chance to be developed into something more than just a movie, where Stardust might be one of the examples where, who knows, you know, could this have benefited because this has been like a limited series or something? Sure, it could have been fleshed out and, you know, more into the whole journey and development. I don't know, but like as we get prepared for later this year to have Sandman come out on Netflix.
So excited for Sandman.
Like, I haven't read that for so long, and then the Audible version came out with an amazing cast, and I've been resisting listening to that because I kind of wanted to go in fresh to the visual adaptation on Netflix, and it's like, a lot of good stuff coming up, and that's one of them. But like, his storytelling here in Stardust, it's apparent, and it has elements that I feel they were able to tie to, but at the same time, it felt a little restrained. Like, even, you know, Matthew Vaughn, who by and large has, you know, doesn't have a huge filmography in terms of directing, but
there's quality there.
Quality. Yeah. Good storytelling. This is a bit of a departure from the majority of, you know, what he's, you know, better well known for. But is it really? Because if you look at, say, even like the Kingsman series of movies, there's something kind of like fantastical. That is like, yeah, it's like a quote unquote normal type movie that could have been taken, you know, the helm could have been taken by someone else, and who knows where it would have gone. Maybe it would have been a more traditional action movie, you know, maybe it'd be a little bit more of a James Bond type take on a movie, but he made it something unique while working with material that in and of itself, you know, it's not tremendously unique until you take those screenplays and interpret it with the unique action and like all the different styling that he does. And so you see a bit of that connection here in Stardust, even though, you know, he's more limited in what you can do with effects, and we don't really get into too much of the fantastical, but even just the practical combination of some of the CGI stuff was a little bit questionable, but like,
yeah,
the airship stuff was, you know, that was just pretty standard. There was nothing amazing about it, but it was like, I just bought into the fact that this was a part of this world, and it kind of gives you, you know, a bit of a hint of, I don't know if you'd call it steampunk, but like some
of that's the feel that I got from the airship, though, is very like steampunk. Like, yeah. Obviously they didn't have like the goggles and all that other stuff.
Well, they did have goggles.
They did. Yeah. When they were doing the lightning collection, they did have the goggles, but like, you're right though. Like, imagine, take the Kingsman. Imagine if Matthew Vaughn hadn't made that, if it had been, say, the Russo brothers who did Captain America, the Winter Soldier, like, we would have gotten much more serious kind of spy thriller sort of deal and not what we got. But Matthew Vaughn has an eye for quality, and I think that we saw that in Stardust. And, yeah, obviously there were certain issues with certain effects, just because 1990 to 2010 or 2012, like, CGI just was not good. Like, yeah. It just wasn't. Like, we have to face that fact. 1988 to 2010 or 2012 just was not good. We have to get over that and move on.
I think that's
for
why
what it was. I would say that it was still on the high end of that era in terms of quality CGI, but the rest of the effects were on point. Like, stuff where you didn't really have a point of reference, like, yeah, obviously the chain reconnecting itself, you know, not great. Some of the other effects, not great, but, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer shooting green fire out of her hands, like, there's no point of reference for that, so of course it's fucking great.
Yeah, no, it was fine, and I think just in general, I think that's why certain exceptions to the rule that you stated really stick out, because there were a lot of keystone movies and special effects through that time period that did things remarkably well, especially almost to the point of putting pressure on every other movie out there to utilize this new technology to try to create these effects and do these things. And you know, like, to go back and say, yeah, 13 years before this, you were having, you know, dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. You know, it's like, like, these things, like, there were examples when people really got it right, but you're right. Like, so many of these people don't know how to use the technology, but it was all the rage and everybody wanted CGI effects in their movies. And sometimes it worked better than others. And this, for the most part, succeeds. It's certainly not a distraction on by any means.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So it's like, and because it's a fantastical world, like, when things are a little bit off or weird, it's like, I accept it better than if we were doing like a straight laced action movie and there was just a bad explosion, because it'd be like, what? But in here, if some guy has, like, sometimes it's it's more of the intellectual processing of like an action scene that bothers me. Like, one of the few things that for whatever reason, it just annoyed me was the what do you call it when a witch makes a little doll, a voodoo doll, I guess you'd call it. There might be a better term for it, but where she's controlling the last prince in line from
that,
the
Kingdom. Yeah, I mean, that's all that I know it really as is a voodoo doll.
So, like, okay,
but I know she's using that little clay figure,
yeah,
and like, so bending its limbs.
Right, and that's fine. I'm fine, whatever you want to say. But that's not what bothered me. What bothered me was when they got into the big sword fight after he was dead.
See, and I thought that was actually really neat. It was very well conceived.
No, it wasn't well conceived. It was well executed for an action piece. But the conceit there is she is controlling his every move with her hands on the little doll, right?
Right.
She's not even looking at him half the time. She's like tripping on stairs and falling away as she's twisting the arms on this doll. And he's like doing back bends and flips and like doing all these things. Now, if she just done a spell on the doll and whispered into it, like, attack, and he came back from the dead and fought all weird and stuff, I'd be fine. But it was this idea. And again, it just, this is my own mental problem. I know I have problems. And this is one of them.
Oh, it's certainly a mental problem.
Yeah. So it was like, there could be things that other people might go, oh, I didn't like this part. But for me, it's like some little eccentric, weird thing like, wait a second. She's a witch who is already demonstrated. She like bends the arm, his arm bends like it's a 1-to-1 ratio. And then she's just like just bending his arms back and forth. And his entire body is being a master swordsman, even though it has nothing to do with what she's doing with her hands on the doll. That bothered me. I don't know what I can tell you. I just got to say it.
I was willing to suspend disbelief for that too. Like it just, it just didn't bother me. Like I was fine with it.
And that's, I don't expect the vast majority of humans to be bothered by that. It just somehow got under my skin.
Well, at least you've tempered your expectations.
Exactly. So now that we've tackled that,
yes.
I think it's interesting. Like, I definitely, like, I'm thinking of the character of, what's her face? The star.
Yvain,
by Claire Danes. And there was something I was trying to put my finger on, and I want to see if you felt the same way, or maybe I'm just kind of off kilter on this as well. Like, I really like Claire Danes as an actress. And I thought she was fine in this part, but there was something that, and maybe again, this goes back to my experience of reading the book first, but like, I wanted her to be even more ungrounded, even more detached from being a human and being unfamiliar. Like, it seems like she, aside from the whole, like, not being able to sleep, you know, at night thing, that she seems to adjust to being in a human body and human form relatively quickly.
Yes, I agree with that very, very much. I took a issue with a little bit of that, not enough to have it be like a huge detractor, but the fact that she just took to eating, like, oh, I'm just going to eat food now, even though I'm a star and eating food is not a thing I've ever done or thought of doing or wanted to do or anything like that. I'm just going to go and eat and drink water and take a bath and all these things that human beings do and not stars.
Yeah, because it's like I appreciate like the whole taking a bath thing. Like it wasn't her idea. It was like drawn up and done for her. And the fact that she would delight in the sensation of that, like that is cool. I can buy that. And maybe that's why every chance she gets at that point is to take a bath.
Sure. But that first time, there's no question of what the fuck am I supposed to do with this big tub of water? Like, you want to get into it? Are you insane? I'm a star. I will burn and steam. Like, there was never a moment of hesitation there. She's just like, oh, okay, this lady wants me to get into the bathtub. All right, fuck it.
Yeah. So it is, again, it's not the biggest, you know, complaint in the world. But I think there were enough small storytelling detachments that kept me from being like, it's an instant classic. Even though Matthew Vaughn, I mean, has actually, like, literally said one of his big inspirations for, you know, and putting this together and the feel of it was, like, he wanted to aspire to the levels of The Princess Bride. And so, like, that modern-day fairy tale take of things, like, I can feel that inspiration in this, you know, wanting to capture that, but I feel like it never quite gets to that level, and to be fair, in my mind, like, no other movie ever has, so it's not like a common thing for people to be able to reach that level of storytelling where it just bends all genres and you're just left with something that's wonderful. It definitely is not bad, but for me, I don't know if I'll ever watch this again.
See, I think I will. I don't think I'll watch it with the same frequency that I do, say, The Princess Bride, like you'd mentioned, or Lord of the Rings, or Die Hard, or you know, any other movie that I, you know, see as a classic or yeah, a great Christmas film or anything like that. But I'll definitely watch it again. Well, I say that, but I haven't watched it since 2009, so we're talking about, you know, 12 years. But I enjoyed it enough this go around that I think I would like to watch it again sooner. Maybe 8 or 9 years. But no, it's funny you make the comparison to The Princess Bride, because it does have many of those same sort of elements, like
fencing, fighting, torture, revenge, true love, miracles.
The only thing it's missing is Peter Falk and
but you have Peter O'Toole.
Fred Savage. Oh, it has Peter O'Toole. That's true. Do we have a Fred in this?
No.
No?
Unless you count, unless you...
Weasley? You know, that's not Fred Weasley.
No.
Ferdy? Ferdy the Fence? Ricky Gervais? Anyway, but it has a lot of those same elements, and it is very similar in many ways in terms of the emotional incitement and things like that. So I definitely get where you're coming from there. So there were a few characters in this, or actors in this, who I looked at and I said, oh, that's, you know, this person, or oh, that's that person, and it super wasn't. The number one
when example, you thought the narrator was Patrick Stewart?
No. I'm talking about characters that you could actually see. So one example is the quote unquote skinny pirate. He's sort of like the first mate. I was like, oh, that's fucking Harry Connick Jr. Nope, it's not.
Yep, it's not.
Super, super not Harry Connick Jr., although he does look like Harry Connick Jr. If I put side by side, it's pretty close. It's not super close, but it's close enough.
Because I got in that mode where I was recognizing, like, every person, I was trying to remember who Tristan's dad, like, the older version of his dad, was, as well as the woman who plays... his mom. And those were two people who I thought for sure I was going to just click in my head and I can never figure out. I looked them up afterwards and I'm like, nope, no clue. I don't know who they are at all. And so it was like almost like that reverse thing of where you feel satisfaction when you finally remember who someone was. In this case, it was like, no, there were a few where they looked like very familiar to me and yet I can't imagine why.
Well, and what's funny is like some of them have been in things that I would recognize, but they're bit parts that I would just have glanced over and been like, oh, this is just a, you know, some rando in a movie. Like for instance, Beverly Hills Ninja, Nathaniel Parker, who played, Dunstan.
Which Beverly Hills Ninja just popped onto Netflix as well.
Oh, well, that's what we're doing next week, folks. No,
I mean, we're just writing. History's writing itself. We're not going to do Beverly Hills Ninja before Tommy Boy. That's for sure.
No, we will do Tommy Boy long before we do Beverly Hills Ninja. But yeah, no, it was just there were a lot of those sort of familiar faces that turned out to be not the actual actor, which was kind of weird. Like I usually have a pretty good barometer for that, and this time around it was just nope, you're wrong.
Well, I mean, I think in all fairness you should be used to being wrong.
This is a sick burn.
Thank you, well deserved.
Yes. What else you got, John?
Well, you know, it's funny. I do like when we do that one segment, of which I won't say out loud because I don't want to bring up any other button mashing in this episode.
Oh, okay.
But so and I, yeah. Oh man.
No, we're not going to do a Dreamcasting on this.
Right. But it is interesting when I even just because I do that all the time in my head, whether it's a segment for a podcast or not. I always think about such things. And what struck me in this movie was, and again, this is not because it was like a bad movie, but I just don't really have a desire to remake what this is. You know, I don't feel fueled by the idea of what a creative way I can maybe recast it and redo it. Like, no, that just, it just didn't strike me as I didn't have that level of inspiration. And again, it's its own little thing. It's perfectly fine. But it falls into that weird category of movie that I'm not super passionate about in either way. Like, it was a perfectly fine experience. I'm glad we did it. And it's just tie a little bow on it and we're done.
Well, and to that point, like, this is, I wouldn't even call this a perfect film by any means, but it's complete. Like,
it is complete.
The casting is complete. The storytelling is complete. And there's, we don't need to imagine what if. I mean, we can a little bit, like you had mentioned earlier about, you know, could they have done a, you know, a short Amazon series, for example, like they did with Good Omens? Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that there's enough left in the book that you could go, oh, well, we could just turn this into a, you know, a mini series and, you know, market it for an entirely new group of people who otherwise have not been exposed to Stardust. Because it's not like this got wide release or wide praise or anything like that. Like, truth be told, I found this movie in a shop in Guyana. Like, there's
typical.
There was a little shop in Guyana that sold, you know, bootleg DVDs, and I happened upon it as I was looking through DVDs and saw I saw Michelle Pfeiffer and Robert De Niro on it, and I was like, oh, this is probably good, so I will pick this up. And it turned out to be really good. But nobody I knew had even heard of it.
It was either that or getting that Mogwai, and you went with the movie.
That's right. And I'm probably better for it, because I didn't end up with gremlins all over my house.
But the one thing I always wanted to ask you, and I know this might be a little awkward for you to address here live on this podcast, is why did you feed your movie after midnight?
I mean, look, I thought that the quote-unquote rules were just a suggestion, which is
you should
the same
have known
reason
it
why,
would be...
It's the same reason why I gave my movie a bath, and then I ended up with a bunch of more movies because it got wet.
It turned into Ella Enchanted, and you have to answer for that.
That's right. It's my bad. You know, I'll own that one.
Okay, on that note, I think we should go to the closing credits on this.
We should.
Because we're becoming rapidly unraveled again.
That's not the show, I know. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. That's our show. Hang out with us every Monday as we distill another favorite from our past. We release new episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcast and Stitcher and Google Podcast and Podbean and Radio Public and all those different podcast apps, and on our website, tmdpod.com. You should go there. You should check it out. There's episodes. There's other stuff that I'm not going to talk about right now, because you should just go to tmdpod.com.
We're not saying that there's secret hidden golden tickets that'll let you tour a magical chocolate creating facility, but maybe there are. So
maybe,
you won't
maybe
know
there
you
is,
look.
Maybe there isn't. What are you going to do about it?
The one thing I could tell you for sure is that whether or not you're a Willy Wonkaist, the music in our podcast does come from Semaphore. That's the song Destroying the Evidence that a lot of people who have either seen Willy Wonka or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory have also listen to this podcast as well. This segue was brought to you today by Marlboro.
What the fuck?
I only have two dials that are like nonsense.
Can we
more
legally
nonsense.
Advertise cigarettes on our show? Oh my
no,
god.
No, not Marlboro cigarettes. Oh god, you're hilarious. No, I meant Marlboro apples. There's always a new apple coming out. And
that's
soon,
true. There's like 97 apples.
I mean, I got
varieties
Cosmic,
of apples.
Cosmic Crisp is the best apple. I'm legally obligated to say that. So, now that we've talked about music, apples, not smoking, because that's not legal to talk about on podcasts.
There and it's young bad. Ears listening.
It's bad. I also do need to tell you guys all the other big secret, which is you can email us at thememorydistillery@gmail.com just to let us know at what point we lost you.
it's now. It's this point right now.
You know how it's like you go through the interviews, you're looking for a job, and you're like, I thought I nailed it. And later they're like, hard pass. And you're like, please just tell me why. And then sometimes they tell you. We love that kind of feedback. It'll help us become better human beings and maybe better podcasters. But yeah, like Anthony said, check out our website, wherever you get podcasts, all that good stuff. Even, you know, our Facebook group, we usually do a lot of postings and polls and things. Just look up the Memory Distillery on Facebook to check that out. I do want to thank you guys again for listening. We're on the road to 100. It's coming around the corner. It's pretty exciting.
We have a very, very cool episode coming up for that. So
something different, but tied to everything that's true to who we are. And it's going to be pretty exciting from my point of view.
Yep, agreed.
But thanks again. This has been the Memory Distillery, and I'm Ditchwater Sal.
And I'm one of the other witches, and this has been the Memory Distillery.
One of the other very memorable names of the witches that we remember all of.
Oh, shit.